Hello!
Hello!
I'm Max.
I'm Tess.
And Tess is multitasking because she's also messaging her friends while she records the podcast.
Oh, no! I was just sending one more message.
How are you, Tess?
I'm okay, yeah.
Are you tired?
Yeah, I am tired. When am I not, honestly?
You're always tired. Because you're in the middle of your GCSEs.
Uh-huh.
How are they going?
I don't know. Well, I don't know because I haven't got my results.
Oh, okay.
I think I've gotten the results that I need to get into my school.
All right, nice,
which
nice.
Which is good.
And tomorrow we're going camping, so we're just going to squeeze
which I didn't know about until yesterday.
Yeah, well, we like to surprise you, spontaneity. Which means we're going to squeeze out an episode tonight,
mm-hmm.
which sounds a bit more disgusting than it is.
Yeah, that really was pretty rough.
This episode is with Lucy Sanctuary, who is very, very fun. Therapist, basically. Probably best to let her explain exactly what she does, but mm-hmm. she started off as a speech and language therapist and she's now kind of not. Really interesting person with ADHD.
And you should never get in a car with her.
Never get in a car with her. All right, let's just get on with the episode.
Wait till the end to figure out why.
Bye. So, welcome to another episode. Hello, another episode of Extraordinary Brains, and we're joined by Lucy Sanctuary. Lucy trained as a speech and language therapist, but now primarily works assessing and delivering therapy from a sort of cognitive behavioral therapy standpoint to children with autism. But importantly, you're also a person with ADHD. So you sort of cross the straddle, we might say, the neurodevelopmental kind of domain.
I definitely do. And like, not just me, my entire family are we're all neurodivergent. So yes, I live it and I work it.
Excellent. So welcome. And we're just going to go kick straight on with our first question from Tess.
Okay. Hello.
Hi.
So thinking about when you were growing up, when did you become aware of being different and how did that feel?
Do you know, that is actually such a difficult question. It really is, because my honest answer to that is I had no insight at all until I was about a really, really, like, not that long ago from now, if I'm really brutally honest with you. And I think there's lots of complicated reasons for that. So one reason is, if I think about my childhood and growing up, actually my family was very neurodivergent. But how would I know that? Because that was my norm. So I had no way of knowing that. So my dad, for example, he was very, 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 very intelligent. He designed supercomputers like in the Cold War that decoded spy messages and things like this.
So the sort of thing that took up about three rooms.
Yes, exactly. It was like that. Yeah. He was very cool. And he was very, he was very cool. But as a parent, he was quite a difficult parent because he definitely has ADHD. And when I was diagnosed, I talked about him because when I look back on it now, of course, I see it differently. But he would come home because he worked in America a lot and he'd say, right, let's go. And we'd go on holiday just like that. No plan, nowhere to go to, didn't pack anything, just off we went. I mean, I slept in the car often. We had all sorts of very strange holidays. He would do things like once he came home with a goat. And we had a goat, and every Saturday we would go shopping with the goat as if it was a dog. And we got thrown out of every shop. They'd come over, they'd think it was a dog. So they'd be like, what a lovely, ah!
You look at the eyes, the goat eyes are so off-putting.
And the horns, the little horns don't have. And that goat used to come on holiday with us. So that was also, I mean, I never thought this was weird, which sounds really very bonkers, doesn't it? But I never thought, I have a very strange parent. So I have lots of kind of, you know, memories like that of my childhood. Another time he came home with about 20 ducks and he said, I am not going to use a lawnmower. I read about ducks, how they can like keep the grass really short, but then he'd go off them as well. So we'd be left with all these animals. It was just
unfinished projects, the ADHD.
Oh my God,
very much a marker of that.
So he would never have noticed that there was anything, it wasn't different in my family. That's what I'm saying. So I never had that thought. And then when I went to school, I went to a boarding school And that was really difficult for me, really, really, really difficult for me. And I was very labelled as being, well, they said to me, you are the naughtiest girl that we have ever had. We've never had anyone like you in school before. And they had these, this was in the 70s, so they had these really unbelievable punishments. So first of all, they could cane you. Yeah. But they had these punishments called specials. So a special was where they would wake you up very early in the morning, say like much earlier than now, say like, 5:30, and you would have to get up and then you would have to run around the school and there would be a prefect on a bicycle following you, telling you faster, keep running. You couldn't stop until they said, okay, stop. Then you came back into the boarding house. They would fill a bath with freezing cold water and you had to get into it. And you couldn't get out until they said you could get out. I had more manual labour punishments. Oh, that was manual labour punishments. That's another one I had. I had more specials and manual labour punishments than any other girl had ever had in that school. But the thing that was really confusing for me was I'm not actually naughty. But, you know, I never planned things or intended to. This was to do with being very impulsive, not being able to restrain myself. And if someone said something like, let's drink the wine in the chapel, I'd go, yes, let's do that.
Wine is the best.
So I just, you know, that was really kind of confusing for me because I'm not naughty, but suddenly I was. And I was just in trouble all the time. And they told me, there's just nothing about you. You're not clever. You are annoying. Just insult after insult that I internalized. And yeah. I thought there was something very wrong with me. And I just lost any confidence that I ever had. I had this wonderful childhood, you know, where we did all these mad, crazy things and I wasn't different. It was just wonderful. And then everything changed when I was in a different environment and suddenly I was a failure and I couldn't do anything and just horrible. But I still didn't realize. I mean, I thought there was something wrong with me. Maybe everyone with ADHD, I don't know if you two can relate to that, but I thought it was me that I, but yeah. I didn't think I was different. I just thought I was awful.
Yeah. But I think that's a common feeling. I don't know about you, Tess. I mean, I certainly felt it going through school. I suppose I was a little bit, I was later than you in terms of school, but it was also a boarding school. And I think that they'd had to get rid of the more kind of brutal punishments. And so, you know, corporal punishment and so forth was banned by then. But on the other hand, the disapproval of difference, the lack of ability to see that any behaviour could be anything but deliberate, that was still in place. And actually, you know, I think about some of the kind of harking back to the good old days that goes on in educational circles. And I think, well, that's what the good old days were like. They were brutal and horrible.
They were. And no, I mean, it wasn't just me that never thought I was different. It was school as well. No teacher ever said, wait a minute, actually, maybe her mind is working in a different way. Yeah, maybe it's not that she's being naughty. Maybe it's actually that she has a problem keeping still, focusing. Nobody ever had that kind thought. So, that's depressing.
It is depressing. But what about the modern kind of era, Tess?
I was about to say, because I mean, I think it goes without saying that a lot's changed.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm at school now, we talked about just before the podcast. I have my first GCSE tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Hooray. So I think it's changed a lot. When I was in primary school, I mean, people caught on pretty quickly to the fact that I did have a problem, that I wasn't just trying to be. I mean, in primary school, a lot of people did just label me as naughty.
Yeah.
Mm. One time I was feeling really upset and I didn't want to go to my maths lesson. So I sat in a little library area and one of the teachers found me and she screamed bloody murder about it. And I was like, Miss, I'm trying not to have a panic attack right now. Yeah. This poor little girl, which was me.
But it's so awful, isn't it? Because they didn't see, there was no empathy for you. There was no, oh my goodness, what, you know, no kindness there. Just why are you not doing what you're supposed to be doing?
But and I think it's definitely way better. I mean, when I moved up to secondary school, they had so many resources that were able to help me out. I think we also did partially select the school that I went to based off of my neurodiversity, which we knew it was there. Mm. We just didn't really know what it was yet.
Mm.
So, and even though I didn't have a diagnosis when I first arrived at the school, they still provided resources to me, which I think was really good.
Yeah. Which is what they should do. It's not, it shouldn't be diagnostically based.
Yeah.
But often it is.
So yeah, that was quite nice.
That's very good to hear, because, you know, in my job, I meet a lot of young people that actually still have some pretty terrible situations. I met a very interesting, I'm slightly digressing here, but I met a very interesting young man.
That's very on brand.
He was about 17, I think. And when I read the notes on him, it was all like terrible. They were saying just, you know, the normal badly behaved, challenging behavior, blah, blah, blah. So I didn't really take much notice of that. But when I met him, he said to me, I'm trying to make sense of my childhood. I'm trying to make sense of what happened at school. He was quite traumatized by it. And he said, you know, I would go to school and the lights would be overwhelming, all the noise, everything seemed chaotic. I'd be trying not to panic, like you said, Tess. And he said, and then people would start telling me to do things. And I just got so overwhelmed, I would lash out and then I would just run. And he said, I was just trying to find a space to go to, and I would hear footsteps coming after me down the corridor. And he used to get into a locker and just squeeze into this locker. And then eventually, I mean, he could hear them coming. Eventually they would open the door and pull him out and punish him. What? You know, I mean, like, I just don't understand that. But I, you know, so that makes me really sad when I still hear things like that from young people. So I'm happy.
How could you see someone who's obviously in so much distress and not have a single part of you that goes, hang on, maybe there's something wrong here? Like, not even specifically mental health wrong, but like,
I know,
maybe they're like something at home. Just like, there should be some concern. Yeah. Your first thought shouldn't be punishment. I mean, in any circumstance with children.
Do you know what the double empathy problem is?
Not really.
So the double empathy problem is when you have two people who are very different, and then that makes it so hard for them to put themselves in each other's shoes and actually have empathy for each other. And so they misinterpret and misjudge things because they cannot imagine what it's like for the other person. And I think that was a massive problem in the 70s and still is a problem like now, that sometimes, so those people that say, get out, you know, you've been so naughty, actually they cannot put themselves in that other person's shoes. They cannot imagine another reason why that person might have behaved like that. So instead of thinking, wow, they're obviously really distressed, I wonder why, they look at it from what they know, which is their own experience. They don't realize, well, we're completely different. Your experience is not relevant to me because I don't perceive the world like that. It's not like that for me. And I think the double empathy problem is like, it's still like, that's the barrier. Does that make sense?
It does. I think, you know, to sort of play devil's advocate in this particular situation, you have to have empathy within, for instance, the school system, but you also have to have consistency and... So there's this thing called expectations. Mm. And I think I sort of understand the argument that you need to have behavioural expectations, for instance. But I suppose what I don't understand is that the behavioural expectations should be the same for everyone.
Yeah, I agree. So if I think back to myself at school, and actually especially as a young adult, one of the hardest things for me was impulses. You know, I really couldn't. I found it so hard to control my impulses and also millions of ideas, you know, and these were things that I just couldn't control. So expectations for me, I was functioning in such a different way to the idea behind those expectations. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it is really tricky. And I think sometimes we don't put inclusion enough into the mix with those ideas like expectations. I mean, of course, there's some things that just we can't have people doing that. I know. But how do you get that across to someone that is very different to the norm you have in your head?
Can I just add one quick thing?
Yeah,
please do.
Say whatever you was thinking and then maybe we could go to second question. But I saw this really interesting, I think it was it the autism simulation of
yes,
I don't know what it's called, overstimulation.
Yeah,
I thought that was incredibly interesting because I'd never really thought about that aspect of it. I wasn't aware that that was a huge part of being autistic. And then I watched the simulation and it all just started to make so much more sense to me.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, it's not entirely accurate. There's parts where they're like zooming in on shoes, and I'm like, does that happen? Does your vision just magnify?
No, but your attention will zoom in on something, which
it does make. It's a horrible thing.
But I think things like that do happen sometimes, Tess. So my daughter, she's autistic. One of her biggest difficulties is sensory, and it's to do with the thinking style, I think, as well. But she will notice something like that and be completely focused on it, and it will kind of make everything else very difficult for her. I think it's so complicated. I think this is one problem, like with ADHD and with autism. You read about the generic, you learn about the generic. There's nothing generic, because we're all completely different, and maybe that's not appreciated enough as well.
I think
That's all right.
Sorry. I meant in the simulation, it's like they visibly zoom in, and I'm saying that it's a metaphorical representation more than a literal one.
Yeah.
That's what I meant, but point still stands. It's a very overwhelming thing to watch, and I can't imagine I can imagine what it must be like to experience.
Yeah.
And what you have is a visual metaphor for the kind of hyperfixation, using the obvious metaphor of the camera. I mean, I think to pick up what you were saying, Lucy, I think it's right, yes, we get the kind of generic, we get the kind of lowest common denominator of these conditions, and we get taught that. But also, the thing that really strikes me talking to people, since I've really started kind of spending a lot of time talking to neurodivergent adults, is that we hear so much about the external manifestations and so little about the internal experience of these conditions. Mm. And I just think, just purely from a training point of view, it's much easier to understand and actually diagnose and do therapy. I mean, maybe you'll agree or not. If you actually understand the lived experience, it just makes you a better clinician.
100%. I mean, I relate so much to everybody I work with and to the families. And I mean, I've got to say that for me, I relate much more to neurodivergent people anyway than I do to... My son says to me, "Mum, you just don't really like people that aren't neurodivergent." I do, but I find it...
I tolerate them.
I find it harder because I kind of like, I'm so different to a lot of those. Like even, when my kids were young, my kids have always been aware we have a very different mum. They didn't know why, but they had a mum who would like turn up late, would always lock her car keys in the car, and there'd always be some kind of like, would lose the passports. I can't cook. I'm not interested in cooking at all. And when I got divorced and I was with my kids all the time, I mean, I just suddenly thought, oh my God, I can't cook. And so then I had this terrible time of trying to learn, and we just gave up and we ate toast, and then my kids actually had to learn. I don't know how to I don't know how to Hoover. I mean, there's a lot of things that they just, I'm really not interested in them. And it's very hard for me to make myself do those things. And unfortunately, a lot of them are kind of like normal things, which normal parents do. So my kids were like, wait a minute, we've been to other people's houses and they're very different to this house, and you're not like anybody else's mum.
And but you haven't produced any unexpected goats.
Well, I do have a lot of animals. And I have come back from a job in the Isle of Wight with a stray cat.
You are your father's daughter in that way. I think it sort of brings us on to our second question in a way, because go on.
So once you'd kind of clocked that you were different, what was your process towards fully understanding that?
I didn't clock it. That's the thing. I didn't. So actually what happened is when I started to do autism assessments, I'd left the NHS after many years, and I decided to go back into the NHS to really, really develop my skills doing the autism assessment. And so I was working for a particular trust, and I was working, obviously it would always be me and different consultants. And after a while, one of the consultants who I get on really well with, and we're still friends, said, "Lucy, can you sit down? Because I have to talk to you about something." And she said to me, "Now look, don't take this the wrong way, but actually every single consultant that has ever worked with you, myself included, we've all had a little chat about you, and you have ADHD." And I went, "What?" And then she...
Oh, wow. It really was that direct.
Yes.
Oh, offline. You must tell me who that was. I have an idea.
Not on this podcast, I won't tell you.
I do have an idea, though.
Right. So I you know, that was like, I don't know what I thought about that, really. It was kind of, yes, it was a shock. And the thing is, it's a very interesting thing because a lot of people have ideas about what ADHD is. So I went to my team and I said, wow, you know, I've just been told by all the consultants that I have ADHD. And do you know what? I think maybe that's true. And people said things like, no, no, you don't. Because there's a lot they don't understand about ADHD. I mean, actually, when I was diagnosed, the psychiatrist, who's a lovely man, he said to me, Lucy, what happens usually is as people get older, their ADHD decreases in the different categories. Yours is so strong in all of these categories. So, I mean, I've got like rampant ADHD, but I mask, which a lot of people do. And I didn't realize that until I took the medication. So I was anti-medication. I was anti-getting a diagnosis. I thought, why should I? You know, I don't need to do that. But actually, when I did my master's, I suppose my awareness started to increase, actually, Tess. And I suppose I started to become more aware that I was different. And I started to notice, oh, most people can actually cook. And, you know, my kids would say things like, Mum, we don't want to go in a car with you anymore. I'd be like, why?
What?
Well, the thing is, because I don't like to do just one thing at once. You probably have this too. So I would be in the car. You're not going to do what I do in the car. But in the car, I would be driving.
You might need a health warning.
Yeah, definitely.
Drivers at home, kids.
I need a health warning. So I'd be in the car and I'd think, oh, God, I really want to paint my nails. And I always have everything all around me. So I'd be like, oh, great, I've got some nail varnish. So I would start, still driving, and then I'd think, oh, I didn't finish writing those recommendations. And I had paper and pens on the seat, so I would start to do that. I'm still driving. And then I'd think, oh, I must phone my mum. So I would have like five things going on at once while I'm driving.
Yes, well, so and I'm starting to see your children's point, if I'm honest. To be honest with you.
I thought you were just going to say, oh, I had to have really loud music on.
Yeah, yeah. No, no, I'm multitasking in the car in a way that... Anyway.
So medication actually was the thing that gave me the biggest insight. So talking to the psychiatrist started to give me the insight where I started to realise. But he was very kind as well because he'd say to me, look at the things that you've done in your life. I mean, I've done a lot. We'd be here like for a year. I mean, I've, you know, all sorts of impulsive things like go and live abroad lots of times, or I'm not frightened of anything. So if I have an idea, I'll just boom and do it. So lots of experiences, which I thought were awful and a waste of time. Now I think I'm so glad they enriched my life and were wonderful, you know. Mm. But so he helped me to start think, you know, you've done some great things. It's not all negative. You're not a total failure. And then the medication was the biggest shock to me because I took those pills. I don't know if you two are on medication as well.
Mm-hmm. We are, yeah.
Have you taken yours?
Yes, I did.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, I don't know if you had this realisation, but for me, I realised, wait a minute, I don't have to inhibit any impulses. I'm not monitoring myself all the time. I'm not checking everything and telling myself, no, don't get up and dance. No, don't. And then I realised how exhausting it is to have ADHD because you're masking those core features of you know, that you have of ADHD all the time. It's not just in autism that people mask, it's in ADHD as well, because you know the expectations, you know what you're supposed to do, but it's not coming that naturally to you. And so you work really hard to inhibit what you actually want to do and to be more like other people. So that was a revelation to me. And then I realised how exhausted I was all the time.
So yeah, and it's that cognitive and emotional work. And we think about it with children, you know, well, why is he so terrible in the afternoon? Because he exhausted himself or herself in the morning trying to comply. And so afternoons often, school's a bit of a nightmare. But it's a pretty obvious answer why that is. And the understanding of normal typical things just requiring more energy is so important, because it sort of doesn't really, you think of people with ADHD with boundless energy, but that's not true. We don't have boundless mental energy, we don't have boundless emotional energy. Yes, sorry.
Oh yeah, I think the whole kind of draining yourself by masking and draining yourself by like holding yourself back is also makes the focusing part, which is the part everyone knows, even harder.
Yes.
Because you've got not only this, you know, disorder that means you can't focus on things, but you're also so exhausted.
Yes.
I mean, it's difficult to get anything done. And then
yes.
you've got executive dysfunction.
Oh my God, that one.
Oh.
That's awful. A nightmare.
It's so bad.
It's and so then bad.
You kind of do nothing all day.
Yes.
For ages.
Yeah.
Yes. And then you get up one day and you do everything and you go, oh, I'm better. No. Next day, nothing.
Yeah. Yes. And that's absolutely right, Tess. And one of the things that people do find inexplicable about neurodiverse people generally is you have one good day, one amazing day, and then you have a crash. And people yes. don't understand, why can't every day be like this amazing day when you did everything?
Because I'm tired. I just did everything. Are you kidding me?
Exactly.
I've actually had burnout, serious burnout, 3 times in my life, where I got tested for all sorts of other things. It was never those. It was that, you know, I don't know. I can't gauge when I need to stop. I'm not good at kind of looking after myself. I'd say that's like a huge negative for me about ADHD, actually. I mean, I love having ADHD, but I feel it's like really punishing on you because, as you said, some days you'll do everything, and you just do more than what I think other people can do, but you don't know it because you've got no benchmark for that. And you can push yourself so hard that you just burn out, and that's just so horrible. So I'm really scared of burnout because it's just awful.
Yeah, and it's really easy to slip into, because apart from anything else, you are expending a lot of energy, and you're also either not producing as much as other people, or what you're producing needs more correction and checking and so forth. Yeah. So it, you know, pressure from pressure from employers or schools or whatever also will tell. And yeah, it's not a surprise that burnout is so common in neurodiverse people. It's a big it's a big problem without an obvious solution, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, Tess.
Yeah,
I think as well, like, you know, the executive function skills that's really a big problem for me. And I don't know about for you two, but for me, I like get it all at once. So this is another way the medication has helped me, because suppose I had like 6 things to do. When I'm not medicated, I just go, like you said, Tess, I just go, oh my God. I mean, I don't know what to do. And so I don't do it, because I can't sort that out. I can't go, oh, I'll do this one. I can't do that. Yeah. And then I try to write lists, but I'll write lots. And then I don't know where the lists are. And then I just feel like, oh, and it's just awful.
Mm.
Yeah.
And the pills take that away from me. The medication, I can do it. Oh my God, I can do it.
So you can take those, okay, what are we going to do now? What's the, you know, step by step by step, break things down.
It kind of, it feels like a literal mental block. It feels like there's just a chunk of concrete in my way.
Yeah.
And then when the medication comes along, it's like, oh, so I can do that.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Well, it's exactly still the same for me. Exactly the same. Mm.
But to show the sort of lack of generic, you know, the sort of the variation within ADHD, I don't think I've ever found that difficult.
Haven't you?
So my ADHD is probably different to yours, which is why it can create problems between the two of us, because I don't, well, why can't you just get on with things?
Yeah, literally. You and I just get on with things. Right, you haven't tidied your room yet. And I'm like, I can't. And you're like, why not? Please.
I leave a trail of mess. I mean, I don't even mean to do it, but just like, if you could see this room, I'm really glad you can't, but you wouldn't be surprised. I can't.
Mm.
That's been really hard in my family because my daughter is autistic. And so that's, and actually the double empathy problem has helped me and my daughter, because, wow, I'm really a challenge for her. And actually, if I'm honest, she's quite a challenge for me because it's so different. But understanding is the key, isn't it? You've got to understand yourself, and you've got to understand each other, no matter how alien that is to you. You have to try, don't you? Like, you two try, and then you can see. It's like going back to what we're saying about school. They never tried, so they're just judged. But that's so damaging to do that to a person.
Yeah,
but it's hard. It's really, really, really hard.
And you don't have to get it right. Trying is kind of enough. You've just got to be in this process of trying to understand
and accepting it.
Yeah, if the other person knows that you're trying to understand, it makes things a lot easier because they know that even if it's not working, you're trying to make things better for them.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that's really, really essential. I don't mind if people don't understand me as long as they sort of try to. But I mean, actually, this is something else I would say about ADHD, and I don't know what you would say about this. And this is something that makes it really hard for me to think about the differences, actually, and to come to terms with my past, because I didn't know then what I know now. And actually, I feel I was depressed for a while after I was diagnosed, because I did suffer, definitely, definitely, and in lots of different ways. And because I thought I was the problem, and also because I instantly like everybody. I mean, I'm like the worst character judge in the world. And also too generous with things. And, you know, I have people that look out for me and will say, no, don't do that. No, don't give that to that person. Or they'll kind of stop me. But I can't discriminate easily between what I should do, what I shouldn't do, who's a good person, who isn't. And I've definitely been taken advantage of many, many, many times in my life and had people be like, bully me, actually, I would say, and that makes me really sad. And looking back on that has actually been a very hard thing to do, because I look back on myself and I want to cry for myself, and I feel so sad for myself. And I think what's been hard for me is to sit with my younger self, and be kind to my younger self, and understand it was never your fault. You didn't do anything wrong. But that's a horrible thing to think about.
So when you say you got depressed after your diagnosis, was it the diagnosis itself, or was it just that process of reflection on everything you'd been through that brought on that depression, do you think?
It wasn't the diagnosis itself at all. I wish that had happened to me like when I was as early as possible. I wish it had happened to me when I was like, how young do they do it? 7, 8? Yeah. I wish I'd had it then. It wasn't the diagnosis. It was what's happened to my life. Because, you know, I wanted to be a fashion designer or a textiles designer. So I'm actually very creative and I love to draw and to make things. And I have a lot of ideas, but I realize now my ADHD was so bad in my early adult years. I went to fashion college, but I just couldn't. I was so impulsive, so reckless, so dangerous that I couldn't finish things. I couldn't focus. And I just gave up things all the time. So I would start different things and just, I've been to college so many times. I'm so qualified in so many different things. I can't even tell you, but I couldn't then go on to do things with them, or I couldn't manage life. And I feel so sad because I'm like reaching retirement and I wanted a different life. I wanted it.
Yeah.
And I always say that to other younger people I meet with ADHD. So people I work with, I say to them, it's great that you know these things now. I never knew that. And I couldn't do the things I wanted to do. But you have the chance to don't let this stand. It should never stand in your way. It's fabulous to be neurodivergent. And you have to help other people to understand that. And your life won't be like my life. So that's what I felt depressed about. And, you know, it's silly, not silly things, but for example, I have so many ideas. I'm sure you two can relate to that. So I have lists everywhere of all my ideas. I find projects all the time that I've started. I have started to write I've published books. I've started to write so many books. I just can't ever carry on with it. And I just wish I could. I wish I could so much. So I felt depressed because I thought I was a failure. And my psychiatrist really helped me with that, because he said to me, I feel really exhausted after talking to you because you've actually done all these things, but you are a perfectionist. I'm going to out myself now. I'm a terrible perfectionist, not with things I don't care about. I don't care about I don't care about things like hoovering or what the house looks like. But if it's something that matters to me, I am a terrible perfectionist. And that also puts me in chains as well, and makes me, sometimes I don't do things because I'm scared of the perfectionism. And he said to me, you don't see actually what you have achieved. And many people with ADHD feel like you're very depressed because they never come up to their own standards. They never achieve what they feel they should have done or wanted to. So that was my depression. And also that I hadn't been understood by I suppose it just replayed in my head sort of lots of things people had said to me in the past that were actually pretty horrible.
Mm.
And they just misjudged me, misinterpreted me. I've let a lot of things go, but sometimes they still come back and I just feel, why didn't you see me? Why didn't you? I'm like the boy that got into the locker. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know. Yeah. It's hard to sit with. It's hard to sit with.
Yeah, that boy in the locker is quite an image. Should we go to the...
Yeah, I think we've been discussing this a bit already, but how do you feel about your difference now?
Amazing. So I love being neurodivergent. I love my difference. I love my creativity. And in fact, yesterday I was working with a young person whose brain reminded me so much of my own. And I made me so excited.
Yeah.
The creativity and the ideas and, oh, I could just relate to all of it. And I think for me, what's really, really important in what is left of my career, so aside from me as a person, is I really do want to change the way that people see this. I really do believe very much in the concept of neurodiversity and there being neurodivergent brains, which are just part of the normal kind of range of diversity, and getting people to stop seeing this as the neuromajority is right. You know, all those kind of, I really feel very strongly about those kind of, you know, trying to change the way people perceive this and understand it. And also to make sure people who are neurodivergent don't see that as like, you know, it's different, not less, as Temple Grandin said. And so I've forgotten your question, actually. What was it?
That's how you feel about your difference. And you sort of started answering the other questions that we've got, but that's okay.
I feel good about it. I feel good about it. And I, you know, I try to talk about it wherever I can. I try to give myself a platform. And my daughter, we're talking at UCL this week, me and my daughter. Talking about, like, you know, we both feel like, come on, world. This is like, you have to change the way you're seeing this. So I feel good about it. But having said that, I do have to have a nutritionist because I don't know if you two will have this, but for me, I find eating very boring and I find it very annoying and I'd rather not have to do things like that, but I have to. So I have to go and see a nutritionist. And I also have decided to see a therapist to really be able to accept everything that's happened in the past and really feel okay with it.
I mean, you've said it in kind of a bright and kind of cheerful way, but some of the stuff that happened to you in the past, particularly at the school, it's pretty brutalizing and pretty traumatizing, I guess. I mean,
I think so.
Sort of, I agree. Force you to be traumatized. I'm always wary of that, but it objectively very unpleasant, both psychologically and physically.
I have a lot of experiences that I think actually did traumatize me, and I think that's still there. And I think a lot of neurodivergent people actually suffer more trauma than other people realise. I don't know what you two think about that.
I think that's right. I think there's a mixture of what's objectively happening externally to somebody, so getting in trouble more, having fewer friends, being more socially isolated. Obviously, if you take an even wider view, you know, people who are neurodiverse are more likely to be involved in parental divorce, kind of chastisement, physical abuse, neglect, all those sorts of things are much more likely in this group. But also, if you take an internal view, the thing for me about trauma is that it's not, you can't measure how traumatized somebody is by a description of what's happened. It is whether that experience overwhelms their own psychological barriers, although it's not barriers, but they're sort of like psychological defenses. So for me, it's like a wave against a seawall. If the seawall is built up well, you can actually withstand quite a few waves.
Yes.
But actually, sometimes, often I would say, actually, this is why boarding school is often really, people are so vulnerable at boarding schools because they haven't got the kind of family around them to kind of buffer them.
Yep.
But this isn't just a sort of screed against boarding schools. But if your defenses are down, you will be more likely to be overwhelmed. And of course, you know, we're talking about overwhelm, we talk about neurodiversity and being overwhelmed by experience. Well, there you have it. A more adverse environment with a person who is more vulnerable to trauma. Of course, you're going to have more of a traumatized person. So I've slightly started now, sorry. But the problem being that neurodiverse people conventionally will not present in a conventional post-traumatic stress way, particularly autistic people. So you will be traumatized, but you won't fit the textbook definition of trauma, and so you won't be recognized.
And you won't know necessarily that you are either. Do you know what I mean?
So you won't have the language.
Yeah, and there's all the problems as well with like recognizing that and then trying to communicate that. And yeah, it's very difficult. And I think, you know, if you've grown up as well in, you know, I think many people who are neurodivergent, their families are, whether they know that or not. And so actually your whole context is so different as well, that you don't have the same benchmarks as other people for that kind of terminology. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. I think sometimes, like, I don't know, because I think, so if I'm honest, of course, with a dad like mine, there was some neglect going on because his mind wasn't really on being a parent. I mean, he didn't really, I'm not sure he knew he was a parent. So, you know.
Did he think of himself as like a playmate or a friend?
Yes.
Or was it
yes.
a bit more like that?
Yes. Yes. Definitely. Definitely, definitely. Yeah. And so I think, you know, sometimes there's a lot of tricky things that you don't know are tricky. Do you know what I mean? So it's very hard. And I think when you start to get the insight, then you realize all those things, and it's a difficult one, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I've said this before, and it's only slightly related, but a lot of people, I think it's really important. So I'm going to say it again. I think a lot of people see ADHD as neurodiversity light. It's not as important. Mm. It's not. But the point is...
Not as important as autism.
No, it's not as important as just other ones, other neurodiversities generally. I think it is as important. People see it as light because they just think, oh, you just can't focus very well. That's fine. Everyone can't focus very well. It's just a little bit worse for you. You're fine. But it can be really difficult. There are some good parts to it. The creativity, the community that you're given when you are... aware of it, but it can be really difficult. And obviously I'm not trying to take away from other neurodiversities by saying, well, no, mine is bad as well.
It's not a competition.
Yeah, no, it's not a competition. I'm not saying, well, mine's bad too. Mine's bad also. But I think it does get overlooked a little.
I think the stereotype view of it. I think the stereotype view is like what you were saying earlier, Max, that you've got a lot of energy, or like what you're saying, you can't focus, and that's so kind of shallow. That's not just what it is. And as you said as well earlier, Max, it's different for everybody that has ADHD, of course. And I think it's not understood enough.
Mm. No, and it also, I mean, we're only just moving out of the era of people denying it exists. I mean, I think when I started working in Lambeth, there was a really, you know, there were still people telling parents that they didn't believe it was a thing.
Wow.
And that was 10 years ago. That hasn't happened for quite a long time. So I think the belief that it isn't real has become less, is no longer respectable and can no longer be sort of stated publicly, which is a positive, but I don't think it's necessarily completely gone away. You then get kind of questions about overdiagnosis, and it's really interesting. You get a lot of questions about overdiagnosis and overtreatment in ADHD. No questions at all about overdiagnosis and overtreatment in autism, but there you go. Because we both know, Lucy, that overdiagnosis is a possibility. Because they're spectrum conditions, and so it's possible you could over-identify these conditions, but you know that doesn't devalue them if you have a proper understanding of them.
You know what, don't get me onto the subject of diagnosis, because I have some controversial views on that subject.
Well, go on then.
Well, I kind of don't, I'm starting to lose faith in diagnosis, and I'll tell you why. Because for me, if you're neurodivergent, I don't think you can box it to say, right, well, if you hit this number, then we're going to tell you, yes, you reach the diagnostic criteria. I just think it's like much bigger than that. And I think that by boxing it in kind of diagnostic terms, you actually make people misunderstand it, and they don't understand the whole, exactly what it means to be neurodivergent for the person, exactly what that's like for your thinking style, for your emotions, for everything. I feel it doesn't always do us any favours. And you know, there's so many reasons why people won't be given that diagnosis who actually need to have that label to help themselves understand and other people understand. And if the families are very neurodivergent, they're not going to give you the information that you need for the ADI, for example, because they don't recognize the thing. It presupposes that the parents are neurotypical and that
just to say, the ADI is a typical autism diagnostic inventory kind of standardized interview that people are fond of. I am very not fond of it, but they carry on.
Me neither. And you know, lots of times I've had situations where I've been told, okay, the parents have given us nothing. The parents are clearly autistic. And it's not that they've given you nothing, it's that they don't see what you see. So, you know, so, and then I also feel like sometimes, I don't know, that just so many times with the autism, the ADOS, which is what I do to assess young people and children, there are times.
Again, so that's a standardized observation schedule. So you'll do a number of activities with the child and then score them against various criteria.
I don't like the fact that you're going to say, okay, you know, you're hovering around it, but you're not quite there. I feel like, well, how can you say that? Because look at the whole impact on this person's life. Well, you don't know what this person's life is like when they're in this situation or that situation. No. This person, it's bigger than the assessment. Do you know what I mean? And like a bit like you're saying, Tess, the whole, why are we misunderstood? Because people just see these kind of bits that they hold on to, which isn't the whole story. That's in a nutshell. That's my, this is very, you know, this is discussion for another time, isn't it?
Why not now? Just go on.
I'm speaking as someone who has no knowledge on this subject, which I think
a diagnosis.
Yeah, but I think it might be a little refreshing for some listeners. Is I think that the trouble with diagnosis is that we cannot do it so in depth and so all encompassing for every person because there's so many people who need diagnoses. And because there's already a lot of trouble with the system, getting people in when they need to be in, people having to wait for like three years.
At least 3 years, yeah, sometimes longer.
It's insane. And just imagining how much more time it would take if people were having to go into incredible depth. And I think it's just quite hard to find a different way to do it. And there should be another way to do it. There should be a better way for us to determine whether or not someone has this incredibly complex and life-changing condition, but there's it in a time-efficient way. That's the issue. We can't do it effectively in a time-efficient way.
I mean, so sorry.
Again, no knowledge on this subject.
No, you have plenty of knowledge on this
very
subject.
Very valid points. Thank you.
24 episodes now. 24 of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I suppose I would say, just in brief defense of diagnosis, I agree. I think one of the things that is very unhelpful about diagnosis is that so much support hangs off it. If you remove a lot of the baggage of you can't get support in school, you can't get to see this rich person until you've got a diagnosis, then that sort of pressure to make a diagnosis and the stakes of making this relatively arbitrary distinction, you know, along a spectrum of diagnosable versus non-diagnosable, you know, the stakes of that become much lower, and therefore it becomes less of a conversation of, oh, do you fulfill this criteria or do you not fulfill, and more, is it going to be helpful to you to receive this diagnosis? And that for me is always the question, something I explicitly say. Yes. I mean, I think, you know, this is a problem with there's a specific problem with some of the tools that we use in that they give us a unrealistic and misleading impression of exactitude when they are actually just tools that, you know, allow us to place someone somewhere along, kind of fuzzily along this spectrum. And then the discussion should be, well, is a diagnosis going to help you or not help you? And I think so many people in the field just completely forget that that's what diagnoses are. They're just tools to help the person. And so we not only need to remember that, but you also need to arrange the system by which diagnosis is not doing all the heavy lifting.
I agree. And actually, I want to say something which relates back to, I don't know which one of you said it earlier on, someone said something to me about the job and being neurodivergent and working with young people and families.
That was done.
Okay, so I just want to say something about that, actually, because I have a lot of colleagues who, like myself, are neurodivergent. I mean, actually, there's a lot of people who work in the field of neurodiversity, and they are neurodivergent themselves. And
that's the subject of our little mini series.
I love working with them, and I often I really trust there. I feel I am very good at this. If you are neurodivergent, you, I don't know, often you know it's there. Do you, I don't, it's not,
you have a radar, you get a radar,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, yes. And I, so for example, I know a psychiatrist, so he is autistic and he has ADHD. Oh, I love to work with him because he just gets it on a level that I don't know if you can get it on that level if you're not neurodivergent, because it's not just about all everything you know about the conditions. You get it, you live it, yeah. There's something very powerful about that.
And the empathy problem is better. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that really strikes me is that the communication deficits and the deficits of emotional communication are almost disappear when you have an autistic person talking to or interacting with another autistic person. So I think, you know, it is a translation from neurotypical to neurodiverse in different ways. That's the problem. So that, yes, you automatically have a head start in terms of understanding and empathy when you, yes, are yourself neurodivergent.
I agree. And I don't know if you have found this test, but for me, when I was diagnosed, I talked to my friends about this. And first of all, they said to me, oh, well, we thought you probably always were. So that was like a slight surprise to me that they never told me. But the other thing that surprised me was then they started to say
it needed an unusually frank consultant.
But then my friends started to say things like, well, actually, I've got ADHD as well. Well, actually, I'm autistic. Well, actually, I started to realize all my close friends were very similar to myself.
Yes.
So I never knew that. Do you two find that?
I've said this before, but I am part of, I used to be, well, oh, it's quite sad now because school's ended and one of my friends is leaving. It's very sad. But there was this group of four and I was part of it. And you got your ADHD diagnosis.
Yes.
And I got my ADHD diagnosis.
Yes.
And then my friend got his ADHD diagnosis. And then my other friend got his ADHD diagnosis. And now, like, three or four or maybe even five of my other friends are currently seeking diagnosis because they've seen, because I've been talking to them about what ADHD is like, and they go, they've gone, hang on, I thought that was normal.
Yeah. And how could you know that it's not what other people experience? Because how could you know that that's not what's going on in someone else's brain? You don't know, do you?
It's almost like we should be very highly educated on these topics, but we're not.
Yeah. We're working on it, Tess, we're working on it. That's what this is all about.
Yeah.
That's so interesting, though. Is that the same for you, Max, as well? If you look at your friends, are they actually all neurodivergent as well?
No, not so much. But I think the way that I form friendships is a bit different. Yeah, I mean, certainly the people that I really connect with tend to be more on the neurodivergent. And I think, I suppose I would flip it another way to say that I struggle to make proper friendships with people who are neurotypical. You know, particularly middle-aged men who like to talk about golf and mortgages. I really struggle with them. So yes, I definitely gravitate towards the more, you know, the people who are a bit different.
I think it's partially because of communication style, and also because as people with ADHD, I think maybe this is just me, but we tend to go. It's definitely not just me. What am I going on about? People with ADHD like things that are stimulating, things that are interesting.
Yeah.
That's why we like interesting people.
Yeah.
And often, interesting people are neurodivergent.
Yeah.
They have ADHD because they like things that are interesting, so they're interesting.
Fair enough.
That's why it's so often the people who are, and also friends of neurodivergent people who are neurotypical, are generally just really interesting anyways.
Yeah.
I'm not going to make friends with boring people. They're boring.
Yeah. There we go.
It's just interesting, the finding your own kind of tribe without even knowing that you're doing that is just a very interesting thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Shall we move on to question four?
Yes, 100%.
What?
So
not only 100, not 110.
110 is not real when we're talking about statistics.
All right,
and fractions.
Fine. Whatever, fine.
It is real, actually. It's a multiplication.
Okay, thanks. Tess is having a conversation with herself at this point.
Fortunately,
we have an edit button.
Too much revision.
So, question four.
So looking back, is there anything that you wish had been different?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So when I did fashion design, I really love clothes. I still love clothes. And I decided, oh my God, I just can't do this anymore. So I decided I was going to just drop out. So I just had that thought. I thought, yes, I'm going to do that. And some people from the college said to me, you know, why don't you come onto the textiles course? Because you're very creative and you're very talented. And we can see that fashion maybe not be quite right for you, but because it's very pretentious fashion. And I didn't really like that kind of, but anyway, so what I should have said was, yes, I will come onto the textiles course. But I said, no, I just want to drop out. I replay that conversation in my mind all the time.
And how old were you when that conversation happened?
I was 21.
Gosh, and now you're, don't want to be indelicate, but you're nearing retirement.
Yeah, I'm 58.
Okay.
I feel so sad about that. I really do. And actually, my best friend did fashion with me, and she also decided that she just was going to. We hated the pretentiousness. We really hated it. It was so. Oh, anyway, so we both dropped out, and we reminisce about this a lot because she says she also should have made a decision like mine. She had the choice to do something else and said no. And it's just that impulsive, no executive function skills. I couldn't think like that. I couldn't think, oh, let me weigh that up. Let me work out. No, I don't do that thinking. I just go, yes, no, impulse. So mm-hmm. I really feel sometimes people say to me, you could still do it. No, I couldn't. No, I absolutely couldn't. So that makes me sad. I also have always wanted.
I'm glad I didn't say it then.
Yeah, glad, don't say that to me. I also have always wanted to do a PhD.
All right.
I might do that. I don't know. I could have done it before and I didn't. And that one upsets me because I don't feel that I have ever reached my potential. I don't feel that I have ever, like I've got these different areas, the kind of academic area and the creative area. And I don't feel I have really reach my potential in either, and I kind of need to reach my potential in one of those, if that makes sense. So I feel sad about turning down so many chances to do things. Oh my God. Mm.
What would you do your PhD in?
Well, what I would like to do it in is so we don't adapt things for neurodivergent parents, so we adapt therapy for neurodivergent children and young people, but we don't for parents. So we put the parents on things like early bird and Signets, and we assume that they are neurotypical, and we assume just
early bird is a parenting group/course for the parents of children with autism.
We assume that the way that they do those courses is going to be effective for all the range of different thinking styles and for but I know it's not. I know it's not. And my master's was touching on this, and I want to extend it to end up. So that's what I would like to. So I would love to do that, because also then I feel before my retirement I would be leaving something.
A legacy.
Yeah. Well, not a legacy, maybe, but you know, I think on my stone it will say, she was a very dangerous driver.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not really sure I'm that keen to get in a car with you, to be honest with you.
I am. That's very fun.
I think it brings us on very, very neatly onto your hopes for the future.
So other than your PhD, which you've just mentioned, what are your hopes for the future?
Well, I want to live in America for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I want to do some work in America before I'm like, you know, in a wheelchair. I really hope to do that. And I have taken some steps towards that. I also really want to go and work in Tony Atwood's clinic in Australia for a little bit. And I have taken some steps towards that. I mean, I don't know if that one's possible or not. I want to live a little bit more. I want to travel more. I want to unleash my impulsivity a little bit more.
Not on the roads though.
Sometimes I think I get, you know, I've got hyper focus. You two have probably got this too. And then I get very, 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 like, you know, because I'm neurodivergent, because my whole family is, it really means a lot to me. And so I can get too tunnel vision in that, and I can forget that there is a life outside of that. And I want to be kinder to myself and do more things that I just really enjoy and love. So that those are my hopes for the future.
Fantastic. I think that's a great way to finish it. Tess has still not had a potato waffle this morning, so we're going to...
I'm still yawning.
We need to remedy that.
Don't get me to cook it for you, because I'd burn it and it'd be disgusting.
But Lucy, thank you very, very much. If people want to talk to you and pick up some of your ideas, I think the idea about the way that we don't adjust for neurodivergent parents is just fabulous and so interesting. What's the best way of people getting in touch with you?
So I have a website. If you Google my name, you will find me there. I don't often remember to update that, but it's there. And I also have a YouTube channel. Yesterday I worked with a young man who's got lots of subscribers and makes lots of money out of it. Mine's not like that. So I have a YouTube channel and I make videos when I remember. Sometimes my daughter makes them with us and our dogs about all things to do with,
wonderful. I'll put the all the links into the show notes, so that's absolutely no problem.
I think it's wonderful what you two are doing.
Well, we think so too. Tess does when she's not yawning. All right, Lucy, thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.
Hi.
Well, Lucy, such an interesting chat and such an interesting person to talk about. I mean, again, so many of our kind of interviewees just talk about how everything's kind of broken in the system and how we're not doing things quite right for people with neurodiversity, and yet things just never change.
It's because the majority of the people in charge are neurotypical and also don't care.
Yeah, I think it's probably true. But anyway, we will keep trying. We'll keep seeing if we can affect change. So anyway, we hope you enjoyed that episode.
Yeah.
Keep following us on...
Start
following us on social media at Extra Brains Pod.
Yeah.
ExtraordinaryBrainsPod.com is the website.
Mm-hmm.
And we will see you, couple of weeks, and we're going to get another episode out, which we've already got in the bag. And then if you want to come on and if you have a story to tell, please do let us know.
Yeah, do.
All right. And for now, that's it. And we're going to go and put the tent in the car.
We?
I am going to put the tent in the car.
Phew.
All right. Bye.
I'm going to put my coat in my bag. Bye.
All right. Bye.